Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Stories of the Supernatural. And the following is an interview that I did on a podcast, and which I'm titling Paranormal Chit Chat with Marlene. The hosts are all great, and of course, the conversation even better. You start listening to them, and they sound like, oh my God, this is horrible. Now, as in modern times, you find out these horrific crimes, besides certain ones that gain a lot of attention, there was a lot of these crimes like that or worse that did go on back then. Before they, you know, we have all the thing of the internet and the TVs and all that stuff.
And what interests you most about crimes that occurred between the 1920s and the 1950s?
Well, how can I say? First of all, I did it because you could go back further, and I want to say it was a little bit more of a modern time. There was also when you saw law enforcement step up a little bit as far as solving crimes, in other words. You know, there was nothing as such as DNA or anything like that, but this was when you actually saw them starting to figure out, like, with fingerprints, or looking at certain, you know, that usually sometimes the usual suspect was not the usual suspect. In other words, they actually started investigating more thoroughly, especially sometimes when the crimes were committed by a stranger, you know, versus, you know, somebody in the family or a neighbor or somebody that was known, or, you know, those motivations that you get for murder, revenge, love, hate. Sometimes you had really difficult crimes to solve because there was really no connection between the victim and the perpetrator. So those are the years that I would say that they started stepping up as far as solving crimes beyond thinking, oh, it's got to be that person, that kind of thing. So that's why I like that, those 30-year, 35-year time span.
Absolutely. And we're getting ready to dive into some cases, well-known mm-hmm. cases around that. And
okay.
Of course, I have to start with Joseph Crater. And so for those that don't know, in the summer of 1930, after the first investigations of what will become known as the Seabury Commission, Crater and his wife were planning to vacation at their summer cabin in Maine. And in late July, Crater received a phone call, but he didn't give his wife any information over the contents of what that call was. All he said was that he had returned back to New York to, quote, straighten some fellas out. The next day, he arrived at their Fifth Avenue apartment, but instead of dealing with business, he actually went to Atlantic City with his mistress, which was a showgirl, Sally Ritzy. And then he returned back to Maine to his wife on the 1st, before going back to New York on August 3rd. And before he made this final trip, he promised his wife that he would be back in Maine with her for her birthday, which was on August 6th. This never happened. On the morning of Wednesday, August 6th, Crater spent 2 hours going through his files in his chambers, destroying several files, and then he had his law clerk withdraw $5,150, which is almost $80,000 in today's money. And around noon, they carried two locked briefcases to the apartment, and he let his law clerk off for the rest of the day. That evening, he went to a Broadway ticket agency and brought one seat, and then he went to the Chop House on 45th Street, where he ate dinner with his mistress and a lawyer friend. Now, his dinner companions gave different accounts on what happened, with one saying that he got in a taxi cab, one saying that they didn't know, but they later both changed their story to say that he walked down the street, never to be seen again. What were your thoughts when you first heard of this case? And do you have any theories on what happened to Judge Joseph Crater?
You know what? When you start looking, unfortunately, you don't have to look far. This guy, you could tell who he surrounded himself with were people of dubious character, Let's put it nicely. Okay, in other words, you know, it could be a cast of thousands of who the person was that, you know, wanted him out of the way. In other words, because sometimes you will get people that things like this happen to them, where they get murdered, they disappear, where when you look at their background or what they were doing, they can't, they're like, damn, there's this person was not involved in any type of criminal activity or was involving, you know, had, and you're stumped. But this gentleman, he kind of, you know, because this is the thing, he, I want to say he was a New York Supreme Court justice, okay, but who he was involved, he was like straddling, okay, the fence on who he was and who he, how can I say it, who he had mixings with. And by this, I'm not being the morality police because he had a mistress. I mean, come on, really? But when you start thinking of, I mean, to me, when you think of Atlantic City, especially in those years, it was well known to have a lot of corruption, what do you want to call it, the mafia, organized crime, you know, gambling. Remember, this was also the, you know, this, the, it, out of the 20s was when we had prohibition, okay? So, which, you know, you gave rise to a lot of the, you know, things that we saw as far as G-Men and Bonnie and Clyde and everybody was breaking the law and rum running and smugglers, and a lot of that happened in Atlantic City. And I want to say, especially, you remember when I said earlier about sometimes when people get murdered, okay, and I, here I'm going with the, how can you call it? Let's go with the thing that this guy didn't disappear because he wanted to start a new life. You know, let's let that go. Let's say they did away with him. Usually when people do it out of love, revenge, I hate you, they kind of get sloppy when they get rid of the body. You know what I'm saying? They do stupid stuff. They leave, you know, clues, blood stains. Sometimes they leave the body close by or they bury it. You know, like they're, all you need is a little bit, and it, and some of them even confess, you know, they just can't handle it. But usually when you see that disappearance where there is nothing found, like no trace. So from what I understand, he was never found. He was like, psh,
nothing.
That usually, to me, seems like somebody, you know, the cold calculating. There's no emotion in this. You might be, either you double-crossed me, or you were an inconvenience, or something along those lines, where I probably hired somebody even to do the dirty work for me and make sure that they were going to ever, ever fight, hide, or hair of you. Ever. Okay, that, to me, gives it a lack of emotion for... What's that saying? It's not personal, it's business. One of those kind of relationships where you went into business or did business with somebody who you thought maybe, because you were a justice, was going to protect you. You know, like, hey, you can't touch because I'm in, you know, I'm in law enforcement as far as the courts are. You know, you're never going to do that. Guess what? He just found somebody who said, well, what was that saying? No body, no crime. You know, exactly. For all we know, he's sipping margaritas on an island in the Mediterranean, you know. Yep. Again, and back then, by the way, that was, you would be surprised that, you know, that habeas corpus, you need to have a body to prosecute somebody. Back then, that was, basically, you, unless you had a lot, the circumstantial evidence was like, it didn't work. People got away with murder because bodies were not found. Okay, and in this case, you're describing where even some of the people they're kind of conflictive about their stories, you know, and like, oh, we saw him, but then no, and then not. Which this is a lot of times also why the police would, you know, interrogate people separately and call, you know, ask you again and again, because that's usually when either you're telling the truth and you're kind of sticking to your guns, and this is a story, and this is a story before and now when you ask me, versus then you start getting the conflicts as far as timing. If you were together, why did you see different things? That kind of deal. And I'm going to go one step further. A lot of times there's even corruptions on the level of investigations also. Maybe somebody said, don't look too hard. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Throw it in the papers that this guy was being unfaithful with a showgirl. Kill it. Give him a character. Kill his character. You know, because there's always, which is not right. I'm not saying this is right, but it's almost like you try harder to solve the disappearance, possible murder of somebody who's trustworthy, a pillar of the community, versus a guy that you find out is running around his wife with, and, you know, with a showgirl of all things, and you know, his dubious character. It's like all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, whatever he got, he deserved. And sometimes they would manipulate things. I'm not saying this is what the case was, but sometimes you see that manipulation as far as efforts go to resolve it, or, and in some cases where even evidence comes to light, and somebody says, put that away. Hey, I found out that some person saw somebody that looked like him being driven with two guys in the back of a car. Shut up. Okay. That happens.
Right.
You know, especially back in those years where when they made that threat, I can make you disappear. They really could make you disappear. It's even if, and this is what I'm saying, even if you held a very high position in the legal profession that you thought you would be untouchable, all you had to get is somebody that was just crazy enough to go ahead and do it. And he was, because eventually they declared him dead, right? After X amount of years.
Yep.
Because I think it was, what is it, 7 years, I think, was the limitation. Like if, you know, somebody, they couldn't find him, they would be declared dead, you know, for legal purposes and all of that. And then also, again, you know, sometimes these people developed enemies that nobody knew of. Because, you know, you would think, okay, well, let's look at who did he rule? Let's look at some of his cases, you know. Was there some type of defendant that swore, I'm going to get you, judge so-and-so or whatever? Sometimes it's, he had an enemy nobody knew about.
You know? Right. And, you know, sometimes people like to keep, of course, their illegal businesses secret. And this is all alleged. Nothing was confirmed about Judge Crater. But if you are trying to keep it secretive, it doesn't necessarily help when you come up missing or dead, because now people are speculating. Now they're like, wait, I think he was dealing with that person, but I don't know. And you also have people trying to protect their reputation.
Oh, of course.
You know, sometimes you have where I'm going to, you know, dig at this person, make him the best person possible, or I'm going to make him the worst. Like, it, you got to pick one. And if I'm trying to make him look the best, if I think that I'm going to find evidence of illegality, I'm going to hide that. I'm like, no. I'm not going to go talk to a mobster about this case, because then people are going to think, well, why would a mobster want to kill Judge Crater?
Right.
Why would they want to? He was a great person. Yeah, he had a mistress, but a lot of those people time had a mistress when they were that caliber. And his wife also, based on reports, didn't seem to mind either. It was one of those things of, as long as you come home without, you know,
right,
a clean
exactly.
bill of health, I'm fine with it. So, yeah, it's one of those strange cases where I'm just like, you have this high prominence, yet no trace of you. Not, he went that way. He maybe, it's similar to Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, I know that.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know what? That's exactly what I thought when you brought him up. You circumstance. I was like, man, this is like a Jimmy Hoffa thing. Like, good luck on finding any trace of him, anything. And you know what? This is another thing people don't realize, especially like what you said about the wife or anything. Even if she knew something, remember in 1929, we had just gone into the Depression. You know, when the stock market crashed, and if she was living the good life, because she's married to this judge, you know, and on justice on the Supreme Court, even if she knew, because she was his wife and she lived with him, she probably was, let me just shut up. I hate to say it. You know, even because, and like you said, she overlooked that he had a showgirl mistress, was because maybe she was like, hey, the country is hurting economically, but I'm living well. Plus, or who she might have known or suspected that might have done away with him, she's like, let me just shut up and, in case I disappear, you know,
right.
Or she might've gotten a visit and say, Mrs. Crater. Yep. Unless you want to join your husband, when the police come and ask you, do you know anything? You know what your answer is going to be? I don't know anything. Okay. Sure.
Exactly.
That, it's called self-preservation. I hate to say it because a lot of people think, who would not want to get the mystery of their husband's, you know, murder or disappearance solved? But if you really think that these people have all intentions and ability to carry it out, you think twice about it. So, yeah.
Exactly. I definitely agree with you. And this next case has been solved, but it was definitely a pretty prominent case. So this is the case of Charles Lindbergh Jr. Mm-hmm. And for those that are not familiar, at approximately 10 p.m. on March 1st, 1932, the Lindbergh's nurse, Betty Gao, found that 20-month-old Charles Lindbergh Jr. was not with his mother, who had just came out of a bathtub. The nurse grew worried, and she alerted Charles Lindbergh Sr., who immediately went to the child's room, where he found a ransom note containing bad handwriting and bad grammar in an envelope on the windowsill. He took a gun, and he went around the house and around the grounds with his butler, and they found impressions in the ground under the window that was underneath the baby's room, and pieces of cleverly designed wooden ladder and a baby's blanket. The butler phoned the police, and Lindbergh contacted his attorney and friend, Henry, and the New Jersey State Police. On May 12th, the child's corpse was discovered by a truck driver by the side of a nearby road. And this case was solved a couple years later, when in September of 1932, a German immigrant carpenter named Bruno Hampmann was arrested for the crime. The trial lasted for about a month, and he was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. Despite his conviction, he continued to profess his innocence, but all appeals failed, and he was executed in the electric chair at the New Jersey State Prison on April 3rd, 1936. And this crime actually spurred Congress to pass the Federal Kidnapping Act, commonly called the Little Lindbergh Law, which made transporting a kidnapping victim across state lines a federal crime.
All right. Right, which is...
What are your thoughts on that case?
Oh, that's why when you get kidnapping cases, you get the FBI in on them, which you think the FBI, it's because if there's a kidnapping and it then it becomes a federal, you know, if they think it's a kidnapping case. That's why you'll see, especially children, you know, that the FBI shows up and assists is because of that, especially if they think that the child was... You know what? I've read that. That there was other suspects that they could have looked at as far as that he was, how can I say it? He was an easy person to prosecute. And I've never gone in depth to like read the transcripts of what happened during the court trial or anything. And it makes you think because, first of all, Charles Lindbergh back then was... God, he was well known. He was an aviator. He talk about the highest visibility. He had gone across the Atlantic. He was a darling. And in other words, whoever did this or was thinking of doing this knew that they were going to get a lot of attention. And my point is, if you are a would-be kidnapper who wants to take somebody's baby because you want to make money out of it, believe it or not, you want to keep it a low profile. All you want is give me the money and I'll give you your baby. You know, taking Lindbergh's baby, guaranteed you were going to get everybody in law enforcement looking for you. All right? Forget it. Just because this is Charles Lindbergh's baby. So to me, there's something there that just doesn't make sense, or somebody really stupid that did this. And the fact, not only was it Charles Lindbergh, but it's a baby. You know, you're taking a little baby and that the child shows up dead. I can't remember if they were able to determine that the child was basically killed from the beginning. In other words, that they had no intentions of returning the child to the Lindberghs. You know, whether they paid the whether they paid the ransom or not. I have heard it, and this is just strictly a theory, because when you get these cases, they get so much that at some point, was it something that actually the parents had done? You know, I didn't know at some point they were like, did, even though it didn't seem like that, but it was like that this guy that was, eventually executed because of it, that they felt that there was some other explanation as to why that child disappeared and ended up getting killed. Because back then, they would have given the money, and you could say, let's face it, that child was not old enough to ID somebody. Do you see what I'm saying? You can never use that child as a witness to point you out as the person that held them during the time that they were getting the ransom together. So that the child as a witness thing doesn't, it's like, why would you need to kill a kid that couldn't say anything against you? This is a baby. It's a toddler. So I don't know. I just think that even though there was a lot of publicity around it, that's another thing. When you get these cases, these high-profile cases, the police and the mayor, whoever is involved, they get a lot of pressure. The public's looking at it, and the public wants, you better find somebody, you know.
Right.
You better produce a culprit. How can somebody go into their home and steal a baby? You know, plus the Lindbergh, it's a baby. So that's another motivator sometimes why certain people end up being prosecuted, and in this case executed, because the pressure on law enforcement is, you say you're great, you better find who did it, right? Plus you've got a million
exactly.
people running around looking for this baby and this kid. You better produce results. And it trickles on down from the mayor to the chief of police to anybody who is, especially if they get voted into, you know, they're thinking my opponent's going to use this against me. Hey, you remember when they took the Lindbergh's baby and you didn't do anything about it? But hey, I did. You know, everybody in the end, I, for lack of a better word, thinks of, you know, what they've got at stake to lose beyond solving the child, you know, the who did this to this baby. And I don't know. I've read certain that I don't think that if he might have been involved, but I think there was more than one person involved in that whole planning of whatever.
Definitely, because you have to think that this was a large estate.
Yes.
That this baby lived on and was kidnapped on. And so the thought of a single person being able to pull off this crime, it just sounds like something's off with it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a recent immigrant to the country.
Yes.
So you have that lack of knowledge right there of
right.
the geography, the setting, the security features that are involved. And I have also heard the theory of, you know, the baby was killed immediately, which doesn't make sense because, you know, you had the ransom note. So why did you do the ransom note if you were going to kill the child anyway? And it actually reminds me of JonBenet Ramsey
mm-hmm.
when I think of that, of, you know, you have the ransom note, but the child ends up dead. So was it that wasn't your intention? That your intention was to have a ransom note and get money that way, but then the child died through a struggle with JonBenet. It was a struggle, and then the perpetrator strangled her. So did that happen? It's just so many questions.
Well, and think about it. Usually, you know, because you know that when you said that thing about JonBenet, you know, one of the things that they said, you know, that she used to do all these little pageants and stuff. So in other words, she was visible. You understand what I'm saying? Where maybe she got somebody that got fixated on her, you know, whatever. But this baby, yeah, he was in the papers, but it's not like, again, like what you said, this is not a child that it was easily accessible for you. And it's almost like, you know, when they, places get robbed, or even people's home, and whoever goes in there goes straight for what is valuable. You see what I'm saying? It's almost like somebody would have to know the layout of the house, know where the baby's at a certain time, okay? Or, you know, when something's going on where maybe the parents, you know, okay, maybe this is the time that the baby's by themselves in this part of the house in the nursery, okay? And this is where the nursery is, by the way, on the second floor on this. You see what I'm saying? Because, you know, it's the same thing. Like, there's some type of inside knowledge, you would think, either the participant or somebody gave them information. This is where you're going to go. and this is where you're going to find the child, or if you're going to come into the grounds, you're going to come in from that side yard where there's nothing over there, and then you're going to do it. In other words, again, I agree with you. This doesn't look like a one-man show. Absolutely not. Just because of the logistics of it. And like I said, if somebody breaks into your house and comes and takes only your valuable stuff, you think, okay, it's got to be somebody that's been here more than once, maybe. How would they know where to go and what to take? You know, quick in and out. You know, versus when you get somebody that robs you that doesn't know, they ransack. They turn stuff over and they go, they're trying to take whatever they can find, you know, as far as if they're searching for something. Same thing here, a large estate, grounds. Which, by the way, back then, sometimes people even had dogs that they would let out on their grounds, you know, their estates after hours. So again, it almost feels like there was somebody there, whether it was this guy or somebody else, feeding information to them. And how can I say it? What you do, let's say, with your baby, it's not the common knowledge. Do you understand? This is not something that's publicized. Hey, at 7 p.m., they send little Charles Lindbergh up for his bath. This is almost like an internal family thing, unless you were somebody that worked there, you know. And they said, hey, what time do they take the baby upstairs? Or what time that kind of thing. So again, that kind of just the preparation and just the audacity, for lack of a better word, makes you think that this guy was just, hey, it had gotten so much attention, because that was like a big, big deal. That story got a lot of attention all over the world, by the way. That I think they just needed to solve it. And what were they going to say? We have no idea. Or, because let me tell you, some people back then, they wanted results right away. They wanted you to capture the bad guys, you know, in plural, right away. Like, because if not, that thing could haunt you. As far as if you were a politician or a police chief, you know, some of these sheriffs, they would get voted into office themselves, you know what I'm saying? And they were only as good as, hey, did you solve these crimes? Plus, that's it. It would just look bad on your records, and how could you not? And I think a lot of people, that thing also that they thought that there's just something off there. Was a child killed accidentally? Where maybe, you know, I've heard sometimes of children that have been abducted and, you know, they put their hands over their mouths to keep them from crying out, and they end up killing the child. In other words, their intention is not to kill. Their intention is to kidnap the child and return the child, especially when it's that young. But they get so wigged out and they're so stressed, and they put their hands or they put a cloth or something in their mouths or over their, and they end up suffocating, asphyxiating the kid or the baby. And then all of a sudden, now you're not only talking the crime of kidnapping, we're talking here about murder and murder of a child.
Right.
And that just, sometimes, you know, you might even have the actual culprits wiggle things behind the scene to like make things look bad, like plant evidence. Hey, like you said, let's put all these things around to just let him take the fall for it. Let him be the patsy. It happens, but I would say that case, despite the fact that it's considered solved, I don't think that it really truly was solved. And by now, everybody that was involved in it is pushing up Daisy, so forget it.
Yes, and we're going to move to my last case that I want to share. And this is another case where most likely the culprit is not able to be prosecuted. And that is the case of the Black Dahlia. This is, for those that don't know, Elizabeth Short, of course she was called the Black Dahlia after her death, was an American woman who was found murdered in Los Angeles, California. On the morning of January 15th, 1947, Short's naked body was found severed in two pieces on a vacant lot on the west side of South Norton Ave, midway between Coliseum Street and West 39th Street. A local resident discovered her body at around 10 a.m. while walking her three-year-old daughter, and she actually thought it was a store mannequin that had been discarded at first. Short's mutilated body was completely severed at the waist and drained of blood, which left her skin looking very pale. Medical examiners determined that she had been dead for around 10 hours prior to the discovery, leaving her time of death either sometime during the evening of January 14th or early morning hours of January 15th. Her face had been slashed from the corners of her mouth to her ear, creating an effect known as the Glasgow smile. She had several cuts on her thighs and breasts, where entire portions of flesh had been sliced away. The lower half of her body was positioned a foot away from the other, and her intestines had been tucked neatly beneath her buttocks. The corpse had been posed with her hands over her head, her elbows bent at right angles, and her legs spread apart. Although there have been numerous tips and suspects in this case, it is still unsolved. What are your thoughts on the Black Diva case?
Well, you know what? At the beginning, you know, when they found her, which I've seen the crime photos. I mean, I've seen the pictures and I've seen like the actual. It's pretty gruesome. It is. Even though by the time they found her, you know, she was ensanguinated. There was no blood left. But yeah, absolutely. They basically left her like on the next to a sidewalk, you know, on a grassy patch. It, you know, whoever left her there wanted her to be found. You know, and it's not like somebody kills somebody and they secret the body somewhere and they don't want anybody. Whoever left that body there, besides the positioning of the body, there's no doubt whatsoever this person wanted that body to be found. Which leads me to believe that, of course, whoever did it is that kind of person who, I hate to say it, is that cunning and intelligent that they did not fear getting caught. In other words, I want you guys to see my, like, you know, your work of art. And it's pretty horrific. But this was somebody that, on the contrary, had no fear of getting caught. And almost, I'm too smart for you guys. And the kind of, which is, you know, one of the things that they were looking at originally was that the way she was bisected and the thing was somebody that had to know knowledge of anatomy. The first thing that comes to mind is a doctor, or at the very least a butcher, which is what they were thinking, you know, back when Jack the Ripper, you know, somebody that knows how to basically chop or, you know, and whoever did this to her, there was also an element of torture involved, okay, which, for lack of a better word, is when you have a sexual sadist. This is somebody that derives sexual gratification from inflicting pain. As a matter of fact, they don't want the person to die right away, but then it's over. So they torture their victim as long as they can before causing death, which they know eventually is going to happen. But once the person's dead, they're dead. It's the torment or the agony that they can cause on that person. And from what I understand, when they looked at her, you know, all the wounds, and she was alive for a lot of the things that were done to her. You know, eventually, of course, she died. You know, you can only lose so much blood or whatever. And obviously, they, you know, cutting her in half, that was probably done after she was dead. And of course, you know, they cut her, like, if you look, like, on either side of her mouth, like, where your mouth ends on the sides, they cut upwards, you know, like that Joker smile kind of thing, up on the sides. When I looked at it, I wasn't sure if it was holes or bites on her breast. It was like, it's horrific when you look at it. But at the same time, which is what they thought, there was a lady in a stroller. She had her baby who found her. And this lady thought that it was a mannequin because, of course, there was no blood. She was totally naked. And the way she was posed, it didn't look like somebody that was either clothed dead. There was no blood. And not until she got closer did she realize that what she was staring at was a woman's body. And you know, God knows, you know, then they get into the thing where her lifestyle was, you know, that at some point it makes it sound like she was prostituting herself part of the time, which again leads to, you know, risky behavior, risky lifestyle. But at the same time, it makes you think this had to be a person that knew, I can take this girl someplace where she's going to be screaming bloody murder, or that I know that I have the time to do all of this and I'm not going to get interrupted. I'm not going to have a neighbor compounding on my door or in a hotel room. In other words, this person had to have a place they could take this victim to and do what they wanted, and then be able to transport her out without no question, as in, I can park my car or whatever in a garage where nobody's going to see me, and I can load her up, and then I can take her out and display her. You know, there's been that, and I'm sure you've heard of it, Dr. Hodel, which was a doctor. He lived there in that Los Angeles area, and his son basically wrote a couple of books saying my dad was the one, which, by the way, Dr. Hodel, shortly after, he was accused of incest against his own daughter. He fled to the Philippines. People don't realize he went off to the Philippines, and I believe at that time there was no extradition. In other words, when things started getting, you know, because he was looked at, but again, when you have somebody who it could be have been this guy, or yeah, we saw with that guy, it's like they cast a doubt as to who was it that did it. And by the time they start getting rid of people or suspects, the real guy is, you know, he's left, you know, or it just too much sensationalism, I want to say, for lack of a better word, because of all the attention it got in the newspapers, kind of muddies the water, because then you have the crackpots calling in saying, it was me. It's like, and then when they question him, no, they're just kooky. But I find that in a lot of the things that I've researched, you'd be surprised how many people actually confess to murdering somebody. That, why would you want to do that? And of course, the police, after they question, they realize that they're off on so many things about the murder that it's not them. That you think, who would want to do that? But it's surprising how many people do that. But anyway, but when you get a whole high-profile case in the newspapers, it's almost like they want that limelight, even if it's a negative limelight. And basically, because I know they threw a lot of police manpower, into finding who did this. But every time they would have to go on a wild goose chase to interview somebody saying, I did it, or I know something. And for all you know, it could be, hey, I'm mad at my ex, and I'm going to get the police on his butt and say that I think that he was the guy that, you know, whatever. Bottom line, I think that... from what I've read, that Dr. Hodel looks like a very good candidate as to who was the one that he was the one that killed her. I'm not saying, again, without something, I don't know, short of this guy's signed confession, his son has made a pretty good case for it. Nothing's ever 100% at this point, because just every time the year goes by, you'd be surprised. Sometimes there's witnesses that just do not say anything. They don't want to be a part of it. Maybe the person with that key piece of information that would break it wide open, and they'd never come forward because they just don't want to be involved in it. To them, believe it or not, in a case like this, the person's dead. You see what I'm saying? Like, they're dead. It's like, okay, I'm not going to get into the middle of that. Or they've got maybe something going on in their lives that they don't want the police coming and asking questions about that, because then the next thing you know, I'm going to get in trouble for this. So let me just, again, in most of those people who might, maybe there was somebody there who saw this guy pull this body out of the back trunk and pose it. Who knows? Those people are all gone. They're dead. The majority of them, I'm sure, I've long since passed on into the, so... I would think Dr. Hodel is a good candidate. So I don't know what to say. That was, but one thing I think that also, especially because of the years that it happened, I think that it's like a wake up that there's disturbed is a nice word for it, but that sexual sadist killers were out there roaming around. And of course, she was a soft target because, you know, if from what I understand, if you were going to feed her, give her some food and maybe pay her for sex, you could get her to come with you, which is a shame, but that happens.
Right, absolutely. So what are some of the most interesting crimes of the 1920s to 1950s that you've researched?
Okay, for example, now that you ended up on this thing with the Black Dahlia, about 10 years before the Black Dahlia murders, over in L.A., it was about 6 miles away from Limerick Park, which is where the Black Dahlia was found. There's an apartment building. It's got four apartments only, and some kids are playing ball, and the ball rolls underneath the building. So one of the kids, I can't remember if he lived or his family member lived in the building, says, "Hey, I'll go underneath it and get it." It had like one of those ventilator lattices where the building's raised up. So the next thing you know, this kid comes tearing out of there screaming, saying there's somebody underneath the building. They call the police, like, okay, what do they got? They got a homeless guy, somebody, who's in there? Turns out that when the police get there, and this is, of course, the newspapers are writing about it, they find a lady. She was a redhead, wearing a blue kimono and a negligee, like clothing basically that you use to go to sleep in. And there's two shallow graves dug underneath the house. And she's, I want to say they discovered her like in June, and she's partially mummified. And later on, they think she had been there like maybe a couple of months. And at the beginning, the newspapers say, well, you know what, they thought that she had been shot in the cheek, like there was this, and that her nightgown was pulled up, thinking that she had been, what they called outraged, this is the wording that they would use in those days, assaulted, sexualist. They couldn't figure out, these two, the holes were like 5 feet long by a foot deep, and she was dressed, they said, but her clothing, which she was wearing, was expensive. It was well-made. Okay, so how did this... So they start talking to neighbors. First, they go through missing persons report. They can't find anything. They talk to the neighbors. Did you ever see a redheaded lady? Oh, nobody comes up. Then they speak to this lady who lives on the second floor. She's an older woman. She's an invalid. And she has a nurse that lives there with her because she can't get around. And she tells police, a couple of months ago, one time, we heard it's like somebody like late at night putting, somebody screaming and then car horns. And she sends her poor nurse down to investigate. You can imagine that nurse must have been like, really? It's like, what's that? So-and-so, go down and find out. But anyway, she sends the nurse down to find out what it is. And the nurse says that when she gets downstairs, she just sees this car drive off, And they called police, but they didn't hear anything about it. They go back to sleep. That's it. That's about the only clue that the police have as far as, and even then, they said, we just thought at the end it was somebody that was intoxicated, back then. And they went back to sleep. Next thing you know, they found this body, so on and so forth. Now, they did find on the lady, she didn't have no personal identification. She had a ring on her finger. And the ring said, from Hal to Alice, August 31st, 1919. All right? So they publish, this thing comes out, this murder mystery, because believe it or not, at the beginning, it was considered a murder mystery. They thought she had been killed and stuck under the thing, So a couple of men come forward, and one of them says, that, I think, is my wife. And they even show him her clothing. And he says, that's my wife. So he says how his wife, Alice, had suffered from this mental condition where apparently she would run away and she would hide. Okay. And she did it once before, and he put her in a rest home. And she got out, and then he put her in another one back in December. This happened in 1937, like in December of 1936, he put her in called a rest home, which I imagine, apparently they did have some type of money, so he kind of put her probably in a place. Bottom line, she escaped, okay? And now she's found. But again, they're saying, okay, if she died in April based on the way her body was, where was she between December and April, those 4 months that she supposedly got out of this rest house? And they were saying, well, the distance between where she was found and the place that he had put her in was like a 5 mile, 5 mile stretch. Nobody's going to notice in 5 miles, a woman walking around a blue kimono, like in a blue negligee kimono with house slippers on, with red hair, walking around. You would think at some point somebody would have called the police and say, hey, there's a lady walking around disoriented, back then, especially people would. So at the end of the day, then all of a sudden it was very interesting. The story then changed totally in the newspapers. And there was another guy who said that, yeah, that's my sister, she had this thing. And all of a sudden the story switched from she died of hunger and exposure because she was scared and she probably barricaded herself underneath the building and didn't. Okay, but what happened to her for 4 months? If that is the case and right. She died of hunger and exposure, where was she from December to April? And who dug those holes underneath that house? You know what I'm saying? And what I'm saying is that basically the whole story, no, that wasn't, she wasn't shot in the face. That was, this is the pathologist after the fact. This was, the decomposition of the body where it looked like it was a hole. No, it wasn't, and all of a sudden they turned the whole story around to where it wasn't anymore a murder by some, late. All of a sudden, it was just some lady that escaped, was mentally ill, didn't eat or drink, stuck herself under a house, and died. And that was it. And it didn't go any further than that. And that was only like 10 years and maybe 5 or 6 miles from Limerick Park. And no explanation was given because, again, that's what I'm saying. There was a plausible explanation given as to what happened to her. So, yeah, that was one that I thought was really interesting because it makes you wonder, how many crazies were running around there in that area of L.A. during those years, preying on easy targets, easy victims. So, there was another one, and I found this per se was not a case in the sun. It was a case, but it wasn't a case. It was something that I found which so interesting, which is where bodies were being found. That we talked about sometimes where people are not found, and others were. And there was one. This was back in in 1940. All right. There's a junk man, and by the way, junk men, those guys were coming across everything. You don't know how many remains and things were being found by junkmen. I mean, it's incredible. That job was like you were guaranteed you were going to come across strange things. Like, you open trunks and it's like, oh my God. But anyway, back in 1940, up in the Oskawana Island, this is on the Hudson River in New York. Now check this out. This is a junkman, and now he finds the body of a woman, okay? And again, she looks like she's dead maybe 4 to 6 months. And she was jammed between water pipes. And there's this, in a little tiny room, this room was like 5 by 5 by 3. Like, when I mean tiny, I mean like tiny. Okay. And it was at the top of a water tower. And there was like one of those little railroad depots that was abandoned, by the way. And it had like a water tower there. And it was 30 feet above the ground. Okay. And the only way to go up into that room was you had to use one of those, those steel ladders that you propped. That was the only way that you could gain entrance into that. And I remembered that I was thinking, first of all, they never found out who she was. She was, you know, by the time somebody's been dead 4 or 6 months and there's no ID, you know, okay, this person's dead. But then you look at it and you realize, wow, this person is, somebody took this woman, because you're thinking, well, could she have gone up by there by herself? Maybe. You're going to go up 30 feet up one of those perpendicular ladders, you know, one of those ladders that you basically you put against a water tower. You go up and you go into a 5x foot, which is like a closet, basically, inside a water tower. And the reason why I brought this, you remember that case of Eliza Lamb back in like 2013, where she had gone into that Cecil Hotel and they couldn't figure out how she had gotten inside the water tower, that water thing, because you needed a ladder and you had to get in there. And how did she get in there? And this was almost like when I looked at that, it was like, man, this reminds me of the Eliza Lamb case, because you couldn't figure out how did this lady get in there if she did it on her own, or who could have can you imagine you have enough heart of a time going up by yourself, up a perpendicular ladder, 30 feet, much less carrying somebody. They found her. That was one of them. That was never solved. There was another one. It was a hotel in Chicago, downtown Chicago. I can't remember where. But it was one of those where it was like 20 floors. One of these really tall. Same thing. I want to say it was in the 30s, early 40s. And one of the times, you know how they would send in their personnel to, when they were expecting a lot of guests, to air out rooms, like, oh, we're going to air out, you know, open up these rooms because we're expecting a lot of guests. So they send one of the personnel, and he this was, the winter's coming to an end. It was winter, but they were expecting, and he, you know, is putting everything together, and he goes up by this window, and he's like opens it up just to like, and he looks down. And on the ledge, there's a woman stuck head first, like about 15 floors up, okay? And he's like, whoa! Again, they call the police, like, okay. They couldn't find no ID on her, all right? And she was wearing, you know, in other words, they were thinking, okay, at some point she had to have been a guest. Because, you know, they were considering, okay, did she commit suicide? And she jumped out. And she basically, you know how each of these floors has a ledge and they have, like, funnels and sometimes ornaments, you know, these older hotels. Somehow she got stuck head first into, like, an urn kind of thing. And she was frozen at this point. So when they retrieved the body, they couldn't, there was no, first of all, they had no suicides. Okay, they couldn't find any ID on her. Her clothing was well made in the sense of it wasn't, you know, like a regular person. She had a coat. She had these clothing. They guesstimated she was in her 30s. And again, they never solved that. They didn't have a missing persons report that corresponded to this person dying. That, hey, this woman that went missing 3 months ago. Oh, we found, you know, this is what happened to her. This was one of those that, again, you know, when you ask me about why these years are so interesting, that sometimes you would die, and if there was nobody to ID you, or that you had some identification or something to point you to the right direction, that's it. They would publicize it, and that was the end of that. And they would end up being, more than likely back then, what the medical examiners would do is they would bury what they call in the pauper's grave, like in the local cemetery. And this is exactly what happened. Was this lady pushed? She might have been pushed. You know? Did anybody ever say, hey, I heard somebody going down? Nothing, you know. Now, the flip side of that is, you know, a lot of these hotels, like you said, were real careful about their reputations. Okay? This was a nice hotel. The last thing you want is your hotel to get a reputation for people are getting murdered or being thrown out the window. Because who wants that? You're very careful. So did the hotel say, yeah, man, I remember 3 months ago, we did have a couple of guests say that they heard a woman screaming. Okay, be quiet, you know. Don't say anything. Last thing we want is it's bad enough that we found a lady head stuck head first on the ledge of our hotel. last thing we want is publicity to keep that story going. There was, there's another one. This, again, was unsolved. And this happened in Illinois. Same thing, way outside of Chicago. There's these boys, this part of Illinois, they used to have mines, okay? But, you know, sometimes they were abandoned after a while. And some boys are playing around, and this was, I want to say, in the 1940s. This was 43, 44, World War II is going on. Boys are playing around a mine that was had been full of water. Because, you know, some of these mine shafts, you know, they're actually, you know, not what people think that you walk into them. Sometimes the shafts are basically on the ground and then they've made tunnels down and things like that. So they're there and they're looking in, and all of a sudden they see what looks like a human hand floating at the top of the water. So, of course, they call the police. Police come and they bring up this woman, the body of this woman who... Basically, they had thrown her in there, and they had weighted her with a big piece of concrete or stone around her. They tied it around her ankle. And when they bring her up, they said, first of all, that originally the water, which was much higher, okay. So in other words, even before nobody had seen, they only saw it because the water levels had fallen, and basically her hand that was floating could be seen at the top. And because the water in that mine was so cold, it had preserved her body. So they bring her up. And by the way, this also allowed them to take fingerprints, because since she had not, like, basically fallen apart as in decomposition, they were able to take her fingerprints. Now, the one unusual thing was that she had big, long, waist-length hair all the way to her. She was naked when they found her. Later on, they found a piece of clothing in there. But they publicize it. They're looking at missing persons report in the area. They cannot find anything. Now, what happened was that, as you know, during World War II, a lot of women went to work at these factories for the war, you know, because the men were all fighting, so you had to go and work. But what happened was every time that you had to work on these factories, they would take your fingerprints. Okay? So, again, they get a bunch of people that had missing family members. Hey, is it this, this, and that? Finally, they get a hit from a munitions factory in, I can't remember if it was Louisiana or Mississippi, somewhere, that this is who it is because of a fingerprint match. So it turns out that once they find out this lady's name, they find out that she was originally from Louisiana, and she had been married 12 times. Okay.
Oh.
Yes, and she would meet her husbands, you know how now they have these dating apps? Well, back then, they had those in the newspapers, you would publish, like, these personal, like, things, which, by the way, a lot of our people got killed because of that stupid stuff, but the same thing, it acted the same way, basically strangers putting an ad, either looking for, or, hey, this, so this is how she meets her last husband. Okay, she comes from Louisiana with her car and her cats or her dogs, meets this guy, they get married, this is number 12 for her, okay, and they go to live in this, like an RV park, like a mobile home park, in another part of Illinois, but, okay, then one day, she disappears, and he tells the neighbors, she went back, you know, we're not getting along. She went back to her family in wherever, Louisiana. I can't, you know. And the neighbors are like, okay. They're like, that's very. Problem is, he goes ahead, he gets married to somebody else, like within months. Like she disappears in September, and by November, he's marrying somebody else. Which, by the way, turns out, why would you do that if you really think that your wife left you, wouldn't you try to secure a divorce? Because at this point, you're basically committing bigamy, you know? And also, he sells her car. And he says, no, she left. She gave me her car because since I paid her way out here for her to be with me and get married, she gave me her car as payment. You know, except yeah, a bunch of stuff. So to make a long story short, they're looking at him really hard, but at the same time, they have no, they can see a motive maybe, but they are having a hard time coming up with, yeah, we have a body, but there was no forensic evidence. There's, you know, at the same time, I can't remember, but I believe there was something also where he had knowledge of that area of where to take that body where it wouldn't get found. Like he dumped her inside that shaft of that mine filled with water, knowing nobody's going to find it. To make a long story short, this was in the middle of the war. And what happened was they brought him up on charges a couple of times, but the prosecutor, they kept getting changed out because some of them had been drafted, or not drafted, but they had volunteered, and they would switch them out. So basically, you know, once you change your district attorney or prosecutor, it's almost like you start all over again because the war got in the way. And to make a long story short, like in 1944, they eventually just failed to prosecute him. And part of it, when you read it, is the sympathy you had for this woman, they kind of like made it go away, because here's this lady who's been married 12 times, okay? It's almost, well, part of this is her fault, which is not, you know what I'm saying? So, okay, so she was a little bit batty. What are you doing getting married 12 times? Okay, but that doesn't mean that she needs to be killed. You see what I'm saying? But the sympathy...
Absolutely.
Towards her, or that she got murdered and dumped, and then that there was no one held responsible for it, kind of evaporates, because it's almost like she brought it on herself, kind of deal, you know. Make a long story short, and the thing was this: they back then they kept her for like a week, a little bit over a week, before they had an ID to her, and basically they buried her in like the local cemetery. It was this little town where the mining was at. She was buried there, you know, anonymously. They didn't know to give her, you know, any name. And that was the end of that. She's still buried there, and nothing came of it. She got murdered very horribly. Probably the guy that did it didn't get prosecuted and went on and lived his life, got remarried. And I remember...